You are listening to a sermon by Janice Kreider, recorded on Sunday, August 21, 2011, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
A couple of years ago, I had an interesting experience when several SFU students came to our house. They were in a special course about food and urban agriculture, and their project that this little group was working on was growing vegetables in the boulevard. It's actually city land between the street and the sidewalk. And on my blog, I had a couple references, maybe some pictures to that, so they wanted to talk to me about that. And they were very excited about their project, and it was fun to see. And one of them said, "After all, food is the most important thing." Is food the most important thing? Right now, in the news, we hear about the opposite of food. We hear about famine and hunger, in particular about East Africa, and there's something in our bulletin about that. But closer home, we hear stories of food contamination, food deserts in large U.S. cities, radiation in fish, and how the changing climate will affect our food supply. How far away are we from famine? Generationally, I don't know if that's a word, but we're not too far from hunger. If your ancestors are from the Mennonite group in Russia, there was a lot of hunger there. A story from my family takes place when my 9-year-old great-grandmother and her family escaped the wars in eastern France in 1874. And of course, they were poor, so they got the cheapest ticket on the ship and had to provide for their own food. The ship encountered a storm, and they ran out of food. And my grandfather said with a chuckle, "I guess they got real hungry." But of course, it wasn't a funny matter for his mother and her family. Food is important. Today's story is a story of drought and the resulting hunger. It's part of a larger story, so I want to give some little background for it. Remember Laura's talk on Rahab? And the Israelites saved her family, but Jericho was completely destroyed. However, not all the land was conquered like Jericho. In Judges 1:28, we read, "When Israel grew strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but did not, in fact, drive them out." And we might not like the thrust of that verse. We won't like the thrust of this next verse either. Judges 3:1-2. "Now these are the nations of the Lord, left to test all those in Israel who had no experience of any war in Canaan. It was only that successive generations of Israelites might know war, to teach those who had no experience of it before." And then there's a list of the kingdoms that were left there, and one of those was the kingdom of Sidon, and how the Israelites married with these other peoples and worship their gods. Each king of the northern kingdom got worse and worse, and more evil and more evil. And Ahab, King Ahab, was the seventh in that line. He married Jezebel, and she was an avid worshiper of one of these other gods, Baal, who was a regional and a seasonal god. The seasons there were a little different than ours. In the fall, they had rains, and then over the winter, they had dew, and in the springs, they had rains, and then they had a long, dry summer. And the dew in the winter was actually an important source of moisture, and right now, if we have a cold night, we also have dew, and that sustains our vegetation to a certain degree, but it won't go on forever. So we're waiting for the rains too. But the god of Baal helped explain the seasons. This is a bit of a simplification, but he was the god of rain. And eventually, as the year goes on, he's conquered by the god of death, known as Mot. And the rains stop. And then Baal gets together with his girlfriend, and they bring back the rain. So that's the cycle of the seasons. But in contrast to Baal, the god of Israel was a god of season. It was not a god of seasons, but a god of all creation, of life, of sustenance, and of death. And let's not think that we're superior to these early people who had a kind of a seasonal god, because our celebration of Jesus' birth may well be related to the seasonal gods of Northern Europe. So to our story in First Kings 17, I've put it into four parts. Part one is just verse one. Elijah suddenly appears with little introduction, and he prophesies basically climate change. It's not going to rain, and he doesn't say how long that's going to be. And no rain means no crops, means no food. And there are two dire implications for Elijah personally. One is incurring the anger of Ahab. I think Ahab gets more angry as 1 Kings goes on. But Ahab won't be able to collect all his taxes if people don't have crops. And there's hunger for Elijah himself, along with a lot of other people. So the next section is verses 2 to 7. Elijah flees to the mountains in the east, where Ahab probably won't be able to find him. And he has a pretty good nutrition there. He has bread and meat twice a day that ravens bring him, and he has enough water. So he has a lot of time sitting there outdoors to think. But eventually the brook or the wadi dries up. It's a seasonal thing. If there's no rain, it's not going to have water. So part three is verses 8 to 16, and this is the core of our story today. Here is where the widow appears. She doesn't have a name, but she's part of our summer series of talks. Elijah has traveled probably about 50 kilometers all the way over to the Mediterranean coast to the village of Zarephath, and that would now be in present-day Lebanon. But at that time, the area was known as Sidon. And it was an area of Baal worship, and Jezebel came from there. So this area and this town should have been part of Israel, but it had not been conquered. And the good thing for Elijah is that Ahab probably wouldn't think to look for him there, especially at a poor widow's home. But the downside is that Elijah didn't know anybody, and he was in another god's territory. The story does not portray Elijah as flitting here and there at his own whim. We hear the repetition of the phrase, the word of the Lord, throughout the account. It shows that God was part of everything that occurred. In verses 10 and 11, Elijah asks for water and for bread. And they're a sort of a test to see if the widow is willing and able to look after his needs for food and water. And her answer is basically no. She has nothing, only enough for a last meal for herself and for her son. But she's, in her response, she seems to know about the living God of Israel. Her answer contains a sarcastic contrast. As the Lord your God lives, myself and my son will die. Living, dying. As the Lord your God lives, myself and my son will die. And maybe it sounded more like this. Your God may be alive, but we're about to die. In verse 13, Elijah says some familiar words, do not be afraid. He goes on to demand to be fed first, not very polite, but then gives a promise of sustenance for the widow. And then we have the miracle of the jar of meal and the jug of oil. And it's similar to a miracle of Elisha. Someone was in dire need, and Elisha had them gather a whole bunch of jugs, and then they were miraculously filled with oil, which they could then sell for food. And it's also, this miracle is it's a little similar to Jesus and the wine. Now, we may have a bit of trouble with these kind of miracles because we try to explain them away. And I've thought of different kinds of possible explanations. But I like very much what I read here by Wendell Berry. He's a farmer and environmentalist and a Christian. And here's what he writes. I don't think it's enough appreciated how much an outdoor book the Bible is. Thoreau talked about a book open to the sky. It is best read and understood outdoors, and the farther outdoors, the better, or that has been my experience of it. Passages that within walls seem improbable or incredible, outdoors seem merely natural. This is because outdoors we are confronted everywhere with wonders. We see that the miraculous is not extraordinary, but the common mode of existence. It is our daily bread. Whoever really has considered the lilies of the field or the birds of the air and pondered the improbability of their existence in this warm world within the cold and empty stellar distances will hardly balk at the turning of water into wine, which was, after all, a very small miracle. We forget the greater and still continuing miracle by which water, with soil and sunlight, is turned into grapes. So part four of the story is verses 17 to the end of the chapter. The widow's son dies and is revived via artificial respiration by Elijah. And again, there's a bit of a parallel Elisha account where they go into more detail about how this was done. So if you want to see the medical procedures, you can go there. The woman blames Elijah for bringing this evil, and she expresses some personal guilt. But Elijah does not acknowledge any guilt on her part. He wonders why this bad thing happened to the good widow who hosted and fed him. And in verse 20, he says, "O Lord my God, have you brought calamity even upon the widow with whom I am staying?" Verse 24 concludes the story with the widow confessing some belief. She doesn't say that the God of Israel is the one and only true God, but she does say that the God of Israel speaks truth through Elijah. Now, I'm going to give 8 responses of mine to the story, and I expect you'll have some other responses later. My first response is it's the longest one. The story of the widow is part of a larger story. For the widow, all she knows is that her community failed to provide for her, and she's at her wit's end, much like Hagar, another of our summer talks. Incidentally, if she had been in Israel, she should have been provided for according to their laws of Jubilee. Now, how well they followed those, and if they didn't have anything to share, it wouldn't work too well, but the laws are there. But she wasn't part of Israel. Suddenly, a gaunt and demanding, hairy, foreign man wearing a leather belt around his waist turns up. And she ends up being sustained through the drought thanks to a god not her own. Her son dies but is revived by the power of this other god. That's all she knows. It's a tiny slice of life. But there's a larger story, and it's a story of the power struggle between Baal and the God of Israel. The son's death is a tragedy for the widow, but it is a sign that the God of Israel is a God of death as well as a God of life. The God of Israel is not limited to being a seasonal God, needing other gods to help him get through the year, nor is he a regional God. In the next chapter of Kings, we read of the continuing power struggle of the gods at Mount Carmel, where the God of Israel ends up bringing rain onto this water-soaked altar, but the supposed life-giving, rain-bringing Baal appears to be out to lunch and totally dead. And the story continues. King Ahab and Jezebel come to a bad end. Their son is injured by a fall through the lattice on his roof, and although there's contact with Elijah, Elijah prophesies his death and he dies. He doesn't heal him. The Israelites are eventually conquered and taken off to another country where they begin the process of rethinking their religion. Eventually we have Jesus and another rethinking of what God is about, and we know that's not the end of the story either. Back to the widow. Maybe we can see how her story fits into the bigger story. But neither she nor Elijah had the privilege of seeing as much as we see. In our own lives, if we look at ourselves, our own lives are like a tiny slice in the whole story of God. And usually we're not able to see how we fit into the bigger story. The second point is that the story gives us a perspective on evil, why we rarely understand why it happens. That's all I'm going to say about that. The third point is also about evil, and it's about evil or disobedience of years ago having long-term consequences. Not conquering all the land, when that was what the Israelites were ideally supposed to do, meant constant trouble with their borders and with keeping up their own religion. Within Christianity, we can see how bad teachings and abuses by individual Christians and by the institutional church have terrible consequences that are impossible to reverse. And one example that I think of, because Walter is here, we were in the Middle East together, and the Crusades, they have had a long-term effect in the Middle East, and I think we're still seeing the effects, I'm sure we're seeing the effects of those Crusades today. The fourth point, the widow took a big risk, listening to Elijah's demands and following up on them. Elijah also took risks. He has this very unpopular prophecy. He took a risk when he said, "Give me your son." He took a risk living on the edge food-wise, and he took a risk when he did the traveling to parts of the world he didn't know, foreign parts. So the question is, do we ever feel that God wants us to take a risk? The fifth point, the widow came to some kind of belief in the one God at the end of the chapter. And it's a story of how belief happens. And in this story, it's due to a relationship, her relationship with Elijah, and a couple of miracles. Now, we don't usually consider ourselves miracle workers, but we do have relationships with many people, some who are not believers. God's story is unfinished, but if we're Christians, we're part of that story and part of people coming to believe. Six, today we would say that the widow had a good heart. And the Bible puts it in another way. It says she was commanded by God to feed Elijah. Perhaps that's all the same thing. The God of Israel was within her, unlike what would have been expected. This God is within everyone because we're all creations of God. And sometimes we forget about this sacred, holy element in another person. The seventh point, maybe many times in this passage, the phrase, "the word of the Lord," appears. The phrase refers to the underlying power of God. Two questions. Do we hear the word of the Lord? And do we believe in God's underlying power? So my last point, eight, I haven't said much about Jesus today. For Jesus, the little slice of the widow's life is significant enough for him to refer to her on a Sabbath day in his hometown synagogue, as we read earlier. No, we didn't read that, did we? No? Anyway, you know the story. We know that food and hunger play important parts in Jesus' teaching and life. Food is important. This is also shown in the Lord's Prayer, and that's the scripture in your bulletin that we haven't read yet, and I'd like you to get your bulletin out and look at the very last scripture there. And it's the Lord's Prayer from Matthew 6. And you might notice that something is missing, the end part. Well, it's missing because it's missing. It's missing in Matthew. And it's missing in Luke. So we're going to skip it today and just do this briefer version. And if you can cut and paste the last line, "Give us this day our daily bread," over to the other column, please do that. And then you will see that the prayer is in two parts, at least that's the way I'm analyzing it today. And the first part on the left, "Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." This is a part that relates to God. It honors God and his work, his power. And it's a little theoretical, because what is his kingdom? What is his will? Where is heaven? And how do we hallow his name? We could have a lot of sermons on all of those topics. But when we go to the other column, "Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts, as we also have forgiven our debtors, and do not bring us to the time of trial, but rescue us from the evil one," we have here more personal and more specific, more tangible things that are being requested. And you will note the first thing on the list, "Give us this day our daily bread." It's right there as one of the first personal things that we're taught to pray for. The note in the NRSV Bible says that this "give us this day our daily bread" could also be translated as "give us our bread for tomorrow." And I think I've heard sermons on that. In other words, give us the assurance that we will have sustenance tomorrow. And this kind of assurance helps you sleep at night if you know you're going to have food the next day. Like the God who provided food for the widow and for Elijah, our God still considers the provision of food important. So I'd like to close with this prayer, and if you would join with me in reading it as it is here, it's a little bit different than we usually have it.
Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts, as we also have forgiven our debtors. And do not bring us to the time of trial, but rescue us from the evil one.